Hi everyone, welcome back to another episode of the State of Venezuela podcast. My name is Rafael, and I want to thank you as always for tuning in. I truly appreciate your support. Over the past few episodes, we've provided a general backdrop for the political and economic situation that Venezuela is facing. We've gone over how we got to this point and how this Bolivarian Revolution project started by Hugo Chavez a little over 20 years ago has resulted in a dictatorship under Nicolas Maduro that today oversees over 96% of Venezuelans living in income poverty and a mass exodus of over 5 million people, one of the largest in modern history. This week, we're shifting our focus to international security. Despite the obvious signs that there needs to be a change in government, Venezuela still has a few allies left that continue to prop up the Maduro dictatorship. So who are these allies, and what interests do they have in delaying the inevitable? We're joined in this episode by Alex from Aurora Intel, a unique investigative reporting platform that uses something called open source intelligence to report on geopolitical events. He's better known as the Twitter account Conflicts News Worldwide, which focuses on forensic research techniques such as geolocation, flight tracking, and social media monitoring. With a special interest in Venezuela, Alex has a unique understanding of the clear extent of foreign interference in the country. I'm proud to host him in his first ever interview appearance. So join us in this edition of the State of Venezuela podcast featuring Alex, also known as Conflicts News Worldwide. My guest today has a very special niche in the realm of investigative reporting. He's the founder of Aurora Intel, an organization with a team dedicated to covering world conflicts and geopolitics through the use of open source intelligence. I'm very excited to have him on today because of his keen interest in the Venezuela theater of conflict over the past year, including visible instances of foreign interference and foreign troops rummaging throughout the country. So if there's anyone who can share with us the reality of the situation on the ground, it's you, Alex. Welcome to the State of Venezuela podcast.
Well, Rafael, thank you very much for having me on the podcast.
So getting started here, could you tell our listeners a little bit about what Aurora Intel is? How did it get started and how would you describe its focus in layman's terms?
Well, there's a few of us. There are lots of different accounts on Twitter that almost come together under Aurora Intel. It's the website that we all write for. There's lots of us and we do lots of different things, but we mainly focus on open source investigations. And we go from doing satellite imagery to geolocation to just writing about news things and getting through disinformation to make sure that the right information is out there.
And how would you describe what exactly open source intelligence is? Because that's something that the acronym is OSINT. I see it a lot on Twitter. There are a lot of accounts that are dedicated to that sort of thing. So how would you describe it to somebody who might not understand what exactly that sort of reporting is per se?
Well, OSINT's kind of, you use social media or you look at photos and try and be able to confirm a location just by using stuff that you don't need to have any leaks or confidential information. You can just use the tools that anyone can access to confirm information.
And when using open source intelligence, what's the greatest challenge you have in using that for your specific role? And what steps do you take to overcome it?
Well, usually the hardest thing is to get the right information out there. There is a lot of disinformation out there. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the hardest thing can be to disprove that disinformation. So you have to be really watertight with your information to be able to 100% disprove some of the misinformation out there. And I think that's really the hardest thing that there is to do.
Yeah, especially when a lot of these countries that you report on have people that are inside of their intelligence units that contribute to this disinformation campaign internally, right?
Yeah, 100%. We see a lot of foreign actors and foreign states purposefully use their own intelligence services to put misinformation out there, and sorting through that can be really hard because some of them do put a lot of effort into making it so that it's hard for us to disprove it with the tools that we have.
And one of the most capable in that field just happens to be Venezuela. I know that's become one of the biggest areas of your research. So tell our listeners, if you could, what led to your interest in Venezuela?
Well, what led to my interest was, I first started focusing on Venezuela in August 2018 with the assassination attempt on Maduro. I did a bit of work online about trying to geolocate some of the videos that were taken of that. But mainly it was January 2019. I looked at Venezuela and there wasn't much English information out there about what was going on and the current events. So I thought I'd try and put some open source techniques in to try and cipher through some of the disinformation that was coming out from Maduro at the time.
Since 2018, you've been doing this for a couple of years now. And what would you say makes Venezuela different, perhaps from other countries around the world that you've covered before or are covering right now at the same time?
Well, Venezuela has a lot of foreign intervention in it, which does make it interesting, especially with the way that Cuba has its fingers in almost every pie in Venezuela. So Maduro almost takes orders from Cuba on what to do. They really are infiltrated everywhere. And I think also with the fact that those at the top of Maduro's government are so involved with the gold smuggling, the drug smuggling, it's just amazing to see from an outside perspective how corrupted it can be in a government.
Yeah, I think for me, perhaps what is less understood by most people who try to grapple with understanding the extremely complicated history and actual situation in Venezuela is this level of pre-existing intervention in the country. Because I'm sure you've noticed this, Alex, but there are a lot of people in the United States, at least, and I've seen this in other parts of Europe as well, people who screech this terminology, hands off Venezuela. It's like this phrase that basically places the blame for all the country's woes on US sanctions, but they fail to recognize, as you correctly point out, that Cuba has a preponderant influence on Venezuela and has converted it into essentially a tributary state.
Yeah, 100%. It's also China and Russia are also involved in Venezuela, and they don't seem to recognize that. They just seem to think the America is all obviously anti-imperialist. So they obviously think we just want America out and hands off Venezuela like that. But there's lots of other foreign states that are involved in Venezuela that don't seem to get the attention from that side.
Yes, Russia in particular. When it comes to military incursion, for now, at least, China seems to have taken a step back and more of a, I don't want to describe it as a neutral role, but comparatively speaking with Russia, because while Cuba is the most influential ally in Venezuela, Russia is arguably Maduro's most important ally and to some extent Maduro's last hope, because Russia views its relationship with Caracas as a way to project power into Washington's backyard. It's the primary supplier of military aid, and Venezuela represents over 3/4 of Russia's total foreign military sales in the region. If you could, Alex, could you tell our listeners a little bit about the research that you've done in pointing out Russia's military incursion in Venezuela just in the last year alone?
Yeah, so in the last year, we've seen Russia almost take a new role. Last March, they sent some military advisors out, and we didn't really know what they were supposed to be there for to start with. But in the last few months, we found out that they are going around Venezuela and checking out Venezuela's radar coverage for air defences. So they've been travelling around, they've been in Táchira, Bolívar, Falcón State. They've been all over the country just trying to improve Venezuela's air defences, but the security that's provided for these advisors is Wagner Russian mercenary group. They're not supposed to be in Venezuela. According to the Russian government, they often deny that Wagner is anything to do with them, but yet we've seen photos of them providing security for the Russian forces there. The personnel there we think has been reduced recently. There was a flight out a few months ago that we think because of coronavirus restrictions, they may have reduced the people there. But there's no doubt that there's still Russian advisors in Fuerte Tiuna in Caracas.
For my listeners, what Alex is referring to when he mentions Fort Tiuna in English, is a military base. I believe it's the principal one that's located somewhere outside of Caracas, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah, that's correct. It's just on the outskirts of Caracas on the side of a hill.
And Fuerte Tiuna is known for having foreign troops rummaging throughout its base. There have been pictures of Chinese troops that were spotted inside, I believe it was military exchange programs, Russian troops as well. And what you're referring to, if I'm not mistaken, is last year in January, just a couple of days after interim president Juan Guaido invoked the Constitution and swore the oath of office, there were, as you mentioned, private Russian military contractors who carry out secret missions for Russia that were reported by sources to have flown into Venezuela to beef up security for Maduro. And in March is when Russia sent, I believe it was 99 military personnel, right, who were described as specialists.
Yeah, it was something like that. There was two Russian cargo planes went to Caracas and dropped both of them off, but we lost sight of them for a few months after that, obviously getting to know the area of Fuerte Tiuna.
And not only that, but they also started some sort of helicopter academy too, right? There was a company called, or some state-backed independent, I don't know what it was, but the company is called Rostec, and they set up a center to help the country's pilots fly Russian-made military helicopters as well, right?
Yeah, so they started a training center because Venezuela operates Russian military helicopters. So they started a center that's got simulators in there for the pilots, but they also set up a maintenance center where Russian engineers and mechanics were teaching the Venezuelans how to maintain the aircraft at this new base they set up that is specifically for training and maintenance of the Russian helicopters.
And what's so ridiculous is Rostec, the company that actually set up this flight academy, we can call it, Rostec made this announcement on the same day that the White House warned Russia and other countries backing Maduro against sending troops and military equipment to Venezuela. So this adds further credence to this idea that Russia wants to act as a principal antagonizer, setting up camp right outside of Washington's backyard.
Yeah, Russia sees this as Venezuela as a strategic opportunity to put its planes, its forces, almost on America's doorstep. And that's why Russia's been so supportive of Maduro, because they don't want to give this opportunity up, because they might not get this opportunity again. With Cuba, the Russians have backed off because of pressure from the Americans. But now we're seeing the same in Venezuela, of America pressuring Maduro and pressuring the Russians to almost get out of their hemisphere. You know, Russia doesn't really have a presence in the Western hemisphere, and they almost want to, because America operates bases in Turkey, which is right on Russia's doorstep. So Russia wants something similar right on America's doorstep.
Something we'll touch on later, Alex, if not just briefly. Erdogan is also an ardent supporter of Maduro. All of these leaders empathize with one another because they borrow from the same playbook that focuses on the usurpation of power. Just in Russia alone, I'm sure you saw this, but the lower house of the Russian parliament approved just recently constitutional changes that would allow President Putin to stand for re-election beyond 2024. Not a single lawmaker voted against the changes. So this is exactly the sort of regime that would come out in support of Maduro.
Yeah, a lot of the countries that support Maduro are very similar. So you have your North Korea, your China, Iran, Russia, Turkey, as you say. They all kind of prop up Maduro because they almost see him as one of their own. He has similar policies. He's also anti-imperialist, anti-American. Now, Turkey's not necessarily anti-America, but a lot of the countries that support Venezuela support them for their anti-America stance.
Would you say, in your experience, Alex, that this idea of pre-existing foreign intervention and the fact that it exists is perhaps the greatest misconception that people have about the situation in Venezuela?
Yeah, so a lot of people don't realize how involved foreign militaries are in Venezuela. Cuba, the Cuban intelligence services are absolutely everywhere throughout the military. And that's also a misconception. People think that the Venezuelan military can easily overthrow Maduro. And as we've seen over the past few years, that's really not the case. The Cubans are everywhere inside the military, and there's informants everywhere, and no plans really ever get off the ground. The only plans that we've seen to have almost, none of them have been successful, but the only plans that have partially worked are ones where very small groups of soldiers take it upon themselves. Because organising something bigger, the Cubans would find out somehow. I mean, we saw that April the 30th last year with Guaido. That was meant to happen on the May the 1st. But they had to push it forward a day because they thought the Cubans knew and had formed Maduro. And we never know if that was the case, but the Cubans are absolutely everywhere in the military. I mean, almost every base will have an informant that will be telling the Cubans what's going on.
Yes, that is 100% correct. I'm going to be dedicating a later episode, just so my listeners are aware, to strictly talking about the involvement of Cuba in Venezuela, specifically Cuba's involvement in Venezuela's military, security forces, and intelligence services, because that really is the bulwark of the Cuban relationship with Venezuela. It's also the principal oxygen that Maduro has in order to ensure that the military doesn't initiate the sort of uprising that we saw last year to a greater extent. Do you think, Alex, that Cuba and its involvement in Venezuela is right now the greatest obstacle or setback that Venezuela's opposition has endured over the past year for trying to remove Nicolas Maduro?
Yeah, I think the Cubans are possibly the biggest obstacle to removing Maduro, because if Maduro goes, Cuba's on its own in the Western Hemisphere, and Cuba relies on Venezuela for oil and other resources. So if Venezuela goes, Cuba will be in a worse situation than it is now, and with the Trump administration coming down hard on Cuba as well as Venezuela and Nicaragua, it will really push Cuba to the limit. But I also think that one of the biggest setbacks the opposition has suffered was engaging in talks, with the Norway-sponsored talks with Maduro. I think that Maduro's greatest ally at the minute is time. Maduro loves to buy himself more time, because the longer he's in power, the more he thinks he can consolidate his power, which then makes it harder for the opposition to uproot him. As we've seen over the past year, almost all attempts to try and uproot him have failed, and that's because he's been able to consolidate his power over the years, so he's got the generals on his side. I mean, they're on his side because they're earning money from the illicit trade that's going on, but they are on his side.
Time is absolutely an essential and beneficial factor for supplying oxygen to this regime. That's actually something that time and time again, other people that I've had on this podcast have been telling me. It's specifically a lack of cohesion among the opposition. Has that been something surprising for you as something coming out of your research?
Well, yeah, looking in from the outside, the opposition always seems very fractured. I mean, we know there's lots of different parties involved and they all have different ideas, and Guaido has tried to unify them together to come against Maduro, and it has worked in some aspects. But I still think the opposition does seem very fractured in their what they want, on how they want to remove Maduro and what they want afterwards. There's lots of different ideas going around. I don't quite think, I mean, obviously the international military coalition or military support to remove Maduro is very popular, but that's not something that Guaido seems to have been on side with yet.
Yeah, some of the people that I've spoken to believe that it is, for whatever reason, of interest for the opposition to buy time. Actors within the opposition that have been bought out by the regime and are now pretending to play this role of facilitating dialogue between the opposition and the regime, and it's being used to legitimize some semblance or at least the mirage of democracy to the international community. Have you noticed that as well?
Yeah, it's what we saw when Guaido was locked out of the National Assembly and they voted in without any legitimacy another opposition leader. And I mean, it's something that I don't know whether Guaido will be able to almost overcome that, because I don't think he does have enough power to, he doesn't have any power to overrule their decisions. But on the international scale, no one is falling for it. Maduro is trying to make a fool out of other countries, but I've not seen anyone fall for it apart from the Russia, the Turkey, China. No one else is falling that this is a real opposition. The European Union the other week said that it was all a farce and that it wasn't real opposition and that they wouldn't be recognising the elections later on this year. And that's because Maduro is not going to let any of the actual opposition stand in these elections. Everyone that's going to be standing in these elections is opposition that Maduro has handpicked.
Yes, that is exactly right. And speaking of the United States, what is your general assessment of the Trump administration's policy towards Venezuela over the past year or so?
I think the Trump administration, it's been very tough on Venezuela, and that's what Trump's always wanted to be tough. It's what John Bolton wanted as well to be tough. And they have been tough. I mean, the sanctions have been devastating for Maduro. They've cut off pretty much all of the income they got from oil. and now with the gasoline, they're being forced to turn to Iran. But the sanctions have been very tough on Venezuela. They have affected the ordinary person, but they have affected the generals and the people at the top a lot more than they have the people at the bottom, I think. I mean, Maduro's seen his revenue. He almost has no money coming in now. Like, Maduro, soon enough, will eventually run out of money to run the country. And I think that's what the US is getting after. They want to make his position untenable at the top, where he can't pay off the military. Because once Maduro is unable to pay off the military, that's when we could start seeing movements inside Venezuela. And I think that's what the Trump administration has been trying to get at. Because the Trump administration, they don't want to intervene in Venezuela. I think everyone knows, I mean, it's political suicide in the US for Trump to intervene in Venezuela militarily, because no one wants another war. And I think that you've got to be very careful with Venezuela, because one wrong move could start a civil war. And that is the thing that no one wants in Venezuela. No one wants an armed conflict in Venezuela, because the refugee crisis we've seen now would be nothing compared to what a war would bring. And Trump knows that a lot of the Venezuelan refugees from such a conflict would head north, and then that would be his campaign was run on building the wall and stopping the refugees from coming in, migrants from coming in. But if there was Venezuelans coming out, Trump would then almost be forced to take them in, but then that he could lose support that way. So I think Trump's been very careful on how he does this, and he's almost gone as far as he can without intervening in Venezuela to try and oust Maduro.
Right. It seems like this administration is stuck between a rock and a hard place. I think the other element of time, like you mentioned earlier, is the seeping of liquid resources that Maduro is trying to use to pay off the military. One of my advisors from my graduate school program actually pointed this out yesterday, that the GDP of Venezuela has fallen below 30 billion. That's closer to the GDP of Boulder, which is a city in Colorado with a population of 325,000 people. So it's ridiculous the level of abject poverty that the country is experiencing, even within the coffers of the regime itself.
Yeah. And I think it's starting to also hit the ones at the top of the regime. They are also starting to feel the squeeze now of the US sanctions. They can't go abroad to many countries anymore. They're having to move stuff out of countries. I mean, we saw the other week those cars in Florida, 81 vehicles worth $2 million were seized. They're finding it a lot harder at the top to get their luxury goods in, but also at the bottom, the normal Venezuelan is the one that is still suffering, and there's not really much has been done to stop that. I think in reality, Venezuela needs a massive aid intervention to prevent people from falling further into poverty and into hunger. I mean, Venezuela, there is hunger in nearly every state. People are only eating one or two meals a day in most states, and they have to go out to work for that. And obviously now with the coronavirus, it's the choice is either you go out and risk coronavirus or you eat your food. And I think a lot of Venezuelans are choosing that they prefer to eat and take the risk of catching coronavirus.
Yeah, speaking of coronavirus, Alex, you published an article on Aurora Intel, your website, just a couple of days ago, I think. And I'm wondering if you could maybe summarize some of the general points from that article for our listeners, because you make some very cogent points in determining that this is something that is very much beyond Maduro's control.
Yeah, the coronavirus will be Maduro's toughest challenge, because it's something that Maduro has no control over. He can't control where the virus is and who it affects, and that is what's going to hurt him the most. The coronavirus is also in the military, which is a big problem for Maduro, because Defense Minister Vladimir Padrino said that there was 160 cases in the military, which will likely be higher than that, and that is problematic. I mean, usually Maduro uses propaganda to try and hide the truth from his supporters, but with coronavirus he can't hide the truth, and he's starting to discover that. Even the other day, Maduro admitted that in Caracas and Miranda the coronavirus is freely moving about there, it's everywhere, and that's why he's had to bring in roadblocks and health checkpoints, because he's trying to slow the spread. I mean, when this outbreak first started in Venezuela, Maduro brought in what he said were tough measures and that he'd protect people from coronavirus. And a few months later, we're seeing that he's not been able to protect the people from coronavirus, and he can't hide away from that. I mean, the outbreak will only worsen. We've seen Zulia State is the worst affected state in Venezuela, and it's also the one with the worst healthcare. So even the governor of Zulia can't escape from it. And we've seen Diosdado Cabello and Tarek Al-Sami also affected by coronavirus. So it's affecting those right at the top, those that are almost Maduro's right-hand men are also being affected by it, which will also scare Maduro, because if he loses some of his right-hand men, who is he going to replace them with? The loyalty by Diosdado Cabello has been over years and years and years that he's earned Maduro's trust and loyalty. But if Maduro has to replace him because something happens to him due to coronavirus, then Maduro is in a tough position of where does he turn?
I agree. That is a very sound assessment. And I think also going back to something you mentioned before, this is where Cuba's role comes in again. Cuban officers are actively involved in suppressing any opposition to Maduro's role. In fact, last year, there was a Venezuelan officer who defected from the General Directorate of Military Counterintelligence, which is the DGSIM. That's sort of like the, would you say that's the equivalent of maybe the CIA in Venezuela? Or would that be the SEBIN?
Yeah, so the SEBIN maybe are more like the CIA, but DGCIM are the military counterintelligence. So they specifically focus on the military and everything in it. So soldiers, generals, everyone, no one's out of reach of them. They almost control the military and control what happens to them. Like we saw with the Venezuelan Navy sailor last year who was kidnapped and tortured and ended up dying at the hands of them. That's what we see. Because he was opposed to Maduro, they come out with conspiracy theories that they were trying to overthrow Maduro just because he might have voiced a different opinion on social media. They rule with an iron fist in the military, and I think that's something that a lot of soldiers and military personnel can't escape.
Exactly. One of the Venezuelan officers who defected from that counterintelligence unit, the DGSIM, presented video evidence to the Organization of American States that showed Venezuelan soldiers and civilians held in clandestine torture centers, he described them as, for people allegedly conspiring against the government. And there was an Air Force lieutenant who defected after recording these videos of handcuffed and blindfolded torture victims on his cell phone, and also corroborated that Cuban intelligence agents were participating in the training of Venezuelan intelligence officials and monitoring all military units in the country. So when you are psychologically conditioned to conform to that extent, it makes it darn near impossible to see an effective uprising, I would say.
Yeah, it's impossible for them to coordinate a large-scale uprising. We know that small-scale ones can occur because they can happen without the intelligence services finding out about them. Just through word of mouth, people can coordinate one. But they never really have any chance of working out on a big scale because it might only be at one base that some soldiers might turn. I mean, we saw it in December with Operación Aurora. They came in and they tried to raid two bases in Bolivar State. And one of the bases, it worked because they had people inside the base that had managed to escape the intelligence services and that managed to uprise almost inside the base and flee with them. And the Venezuelan intelligence services were completely caught out by this. They didn't have any knowledge of it. But that was a small-scale group. We were talking 10 or 15 people. Whereas for something, a big uprising to happen, you'd be needing 1,000, 2,000 soldiers across multiple bases across the country. And that's where the Cubans would find out, because it would spread around those bases and an informant would tell. And then once Maduro finds out, he comes in and arrests them. And as you say, they're off to the cells and are tortured in prison cells to find out more information about it and who's involved.
Right. And that's actually something else I wanted to ask you about, Alex. You had written an analysis on Operation Aurora. Do you know what the status is of those soldiers that participated in that particular operation? Are they still in Venezuela?
No, they're not in Venezuela. A lot of them have been out of Venezuela since, I think, the day that raid happened. I've been tracking them through social media for a while, and I can usually keep up with their movements. A lot of them are back in their home countries where they were living before the raid. The coronavirus restrictions have obviously stopped them from doing anything else. But as we saw just last month, one of the Operation Aurora members had been shot in the leg during the raid and was being held at a military hospital in Caracas. And somehow he managed to be rescued by some guys in Venezuela with the cooperation of active military personnel. They were able to free him from the military hospital under the intelligence service's nose and get him out of Venezuela and into Colombia. And yet again, the Venezuelan intelligence services had no knowledge and didn't even know how it had happened. They went to the hospital the next day and started arresting people, and no one knew how he'd managed to escape from a second floor window. I mean, he had a broken leg and he couldn't walk properly. He needed a wheelchair, and somehow he'd managed to rappel out the side of a second floor window down to a car and get away with the help of active military soldiers. And no one knew how it had happened. The intelligence services didn't have a clue how he'd managed to even escape.
That's incredible. If there is anything that's going to rival a series on Netflix like Narcos, it's going to be the story of Venezuela, because there are far too many tales like this that are true, that are confirmable, that would make for a great story. I wanted to ask, Alex, going back to your technical capabilities in tracking these individuals via social media, I actually see sometimes when you post certain flight patterns or certain things about the Venezuelan military, there are people inside the military with accounts that will respond to you.
Yeah, this is often the case, and it's something I find funny, is that a lot of the time they will respond, and I know that the military does look at the accounts and look at what I post. And I sometimes laugh because they post things where they don't name a location and they don't say anything about it, but I'll be able to find the location and post exactly where they are, and they'll respond to it. And then the next time they upload, they'll try and blur out the location even more and try and conceal the location even more. And I'll come back with a new technique of how to find it. And a lot of the time it's like a game of cat and mouse with them, is that sometimes they try and conceal stuff even more, and I just keep finding where it is and finding the information. I've got a few people at the top, I think I've noticed as well. I know that a few prominent Chavistas also follow the account that are quite high up.
I'm very, very interested in hearing what they would have to say specifically about cyber troop activity, because it's manifested in so many different organizational forms. Their misinformation, also their propaganda. You've posted videos that they themselves post. They look like slick editing, but in reality, they look more like 90s action film B-roll footage. Some of the promos that they will do in showing off their archaic or outdated radar technology or their warships to, I don't know if it's saber rattling, where they're trying to intimidate the United States into thinking that they're a legitimate force, whether it be in the Army or in the Navy, or if they're trying to scare perhaps their own infantry into being reinforced in this idea that they are really a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah, I think it's a mixture of both. Obviously, they want the propaganda to look good because they want it from their own supporters that it looks good. And I think they also sometimes do want to intimidate the US and almost say that they do still have weapons and technology available to hurt the US if they were ever intervene. I'm not sure exactly what they go for sometimes, because a lot of the footage they use is old footage, and I've posted about that numerous times. They use old footage and play it off as new footage, which I think a lot of the time is because they don't want to waste the military equipment. We see them when sometimes they fire missiles. Those missiles are expensive and they can't really afford to buy any more, so they hold back the reserves of what they need just in case there ever was to be an outbreak of conflict, but they don't like to show them off by firing them. And that's why sometimes on the air defences you'll see them use fake missiles when they're on display, because they don't want to place the real missiles on, because they could damage them or deteriorate them, and they only have a limited stock of those missiles. So they don't always want to use up-to-date footage, because then they'd have to use the military equipment, and the more it gets used, the more likely it is to get damaged or deteriorate, and that they really can't afford that with the situation the military is in right now.
Right, and those missiles, the majority of them are supplied, again, just as a reminder to my listeners, from Russia. And like you had pointed out earlier, it's not just Russia that is handing out this equipment, and it's not just the military under the tutelage of the Cubans. It's also China, because even though they present themselves as playing a neutral role throughout all of this, they have provided the Venezuelan military with equipment of their own. On the one hand, it's riot gear, There are certain companies that they have used to supply riot gear that's used in demonstrations or when the demonstrations were still capable of being carried out, but also Chinese radar. You have an article on the Aurora Intel website of Venezuela's Chinese radar acquired last year, right?
Yeah, this was something that came to as a surprise to me and many of the people that I talked to about where they got this radar from originally. And we managed to find out that they got it from China. But to this day, we still don't exactly know what it is. It's never been seen before apart from in Venezuela. We know they received it possibly last April or May, but they didn't take it out and show it off until November. And I actually managed to find some photos on social media of some of the Chinese technicians that have been out in Venezuela for the unveiling of these radars that was by Vladimir Padrino, the defense minister, at El Libertador Air Base, the main air base for Venezuela. And since then, we still don't know much about these radars, but we were able to track them earlier on this year to another air base, the Manuel Rios Air Base, where they have most of their air defense is based. And we managed to track this radar there. And we're not 100% sure what this radar does, or we know it was from China and we found it in China as well. But Venezuela seems to be the only ones that operate this radar. And we think it possibly could have something to do with the Russians being in Venezuela, looking at air defences and radar coverage. We think this possibly could be their recommendation of buying radars, because we know that the Chinese offer their military equipment a lot cheaper than what the Russians offer it at. And as Venezuela is strapped for cash right now, we think that's possibly where this has come in. But this radar, we think, it looks like it's going to be a high-frequency radar for long range, but we can't be 100% sure because we don't even know this radar's name.
I hope Southern Command is taking notes here, because that is something that really does need to be taken into account. Again, not just my listeners, but the international community at large does need to take note of these sorts of incidents of foreign interference. And for my listeners, also, let me, just for the sake of exposition here, go a little bit more into detail about the role that Padrino, or Vladimir Padrino Lopez, plays in all of this. He is the defense minister of Venezuela. He was an individual that supposedly was going to side with the opposition on April 30th of last year during that military uprising. But the guy has no intention of surrendering. And really, from a personal standpoint, I don't see him having any sort of moral scruples, because his own family came out asking him, pleading for him to do the right thing for the sake of the country. But there you see him still right by Maduro's side. And his position was just entrenched even further not too long ago, right? Because they keep reshuffling the leadership within the Venezuelan armed forces, and he continues to play more and more of an important role.
Yeah, so Maduro has been changing around the Venezuelan military recently. He's made a lot of changes. A lot of the regional commanders have left, as well as the head of the Navy, the head of the Air Force, and the head of air defences have also all left the military. We think some of them have retired, but we're not 100% sure what's happened to some of the other ones. And Maduro seems to have replaced most of them, but he's kept Padrino and Ceballos, who's the head of strategic forces for Venezuela. Both of those have been kept in place, and Padrino is now the longest serving defence minister in 40 years, I think, in Venezuela. So he really is one of Maduro's most loyal compatriots. And I think part of that is due to the incentives Maduro gives Padrino to stay on his side. We know Padrino is involved with the drug smuggling or drug trafficking, whatever the Cartel de los Soles is involved with. We know that Padrino facilitates all that, and we know that companies run by Padrino are given government contracts. These government contracts are given to many, many companies that all end up being some official or some general owns this company, and it's used as a way of corruption. So these contracts are given out to a company owned by someone like Padrino, and the work either never gets done or gets done at a really inflated price. And most of that money is just funneled straight into their bank accounts as a way to steal more from Venezuela. And I think that's how Maduro has kept them on side, by offering monetary incentives to keep them on side, because some of these generals and some of these even commanding officers the wage that they get paid by the Venezuelan military isn't that much. And yet some of them are on private jets off to Europe and to North America, staying in Miami. And it's clear to see that Maduro is clearly just paying them money on the side to still support him.
Yeah, and that's something we haven't even touched on. Just to give you, the listeners, an idea of how deep this truly goes, or we've been talking throughout this entire episode about foreign interference, and we haven't even scratched the surface when it comes to the drug trafficking, which is both observed and involves participation by the Venezuelan military itself, but also the intimate financial relationships between Maduro and a slew of generals that have different ties to private companies and sit on the boards of most of them. In fact, as of last year, Venezuela had 312 active generals in its army, and some 84 of those generals work with private or public companies that are listed in the National Contractor Registry, which allows them to do business with the government. And they've all delved into industries, winning hundreds of contracts with state companies, going into industries like advertising, healthcare equipment, toys, tourism. And Pedrino Lopez in particular is the one who is really, he's the one who's really enjoyed the spoil. So he has no incentive to want to leave that particular position.
Yeah, exactly. There's no incentive for Pedrino to turn on Maduro. All Pedrino would be doing, he would be doing what's right for the country by removing Maduro. But there's no incentive personally for him to remove Maduro, because he would be losing a lot of his revenue and a lot of his money. He just wouldn't be getting that if Maduro wasn't in power. I think Pedrino is so entwined with Maduro that if Pedrino goes, Maduro goes, and if Maduro goes, Pedrino goes.
And if either one of them goes, then Cuba goes. And it's this sort of domino effect that I'm sure they themselves have calculated, and for that reason are taking every step possible to ensure that doesn't happen. And with that, Alex, I have just a couple of more questions. Number one, looking ahead, we've talked in this podcast throughout several different episodes about the political impasse. But more importantly is the impasse of foreign interference and drug smuggling and all these incentives that maintain the status quo in Venezuela. So in your assessment, based on the really the brilliant work you've done over the past year, based off of all of the facts you've gathered, what steps do you think could be taken to get rid of this guy?
Well, I think the only real way to get rid of Maduro now, the political way is out of the window. I don't think Maduro has taken that much control of the political side of things that it's pretty much impossible to have anything to remove him. I think the military is the only real way that Maduro is going to be removed. I mean, we saw it in Bolivia with Evo Morales. As soon as the military in multiple areas starts to turn on the president in charge, it starts to get ugly. And the president never wants to, like we saw with Evo Morales, he resigned a couple of days later after the military turn. And I think a similar situation could happen in Venezuela. I mean, there is a lot more groups in Venezuela. You've got the FARC, you've got ELN. There's terrorist groups that do support Maduro that will put up a fight. But I think overall, as soon as the military starts to turn against Maduro in some areas, I think that will be game over for Maduro.
Yeah. And for my listeners, also just briefly for exposition, again, the ELN is a, how would you describe it? The ELN is, it's not an offshoot of, but it's sort of adjacent to the FARC, which of course is the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. The ELN is the National Liberation Front. It is similarly Marxist in their ideology. And their presence in Venezuela has increased a lot over the Venezuela-Colombia border as it took over a lot of the previously disputed territory from FARC, which was a former guerrilla rival. And the reason they did that is because FARC, I don't want to sound biased here, but they were legitimized by the administration previous to Iván Duque in Colombia, and they are now even a political party. Take that as you may. But now there's this long-standing relationship between the ELN and Venezuela's Bolivarian National Guard that benefits from the drug trade. And you're right, that absolutely needs to be addressed, because the longer that they learn to adjust, or the more that they enjoy the spoils from that, the less incentive they have to turn the other direction and work to oust a guy who is allowing them to thrive in a system like that, really.
Yeah, 100%. We know the military benefits from the illegal drug trade and the illegal gold trade. So, especially in Bolivar State, there's not much incentive for the military to turn. And we're seeing that in a lot of places. We've seen the FARC, we've even seen them almost alongside the National Guard. And yet the FARC are internationally recognized as a terrorist group. And yet you have Venezuelan soldiers almost side by side with them. And that's because Maduro protects them. We've seen former FARC leaders have been living in Caracas under protection. I mean, they really are entwined with the current government. And I think if Maduro were to go or leave power, I think that the FARC and the ELN are urgent problems that would need addressing by whoever came into power after Maduro.
Yes, and that's actually one of my final questions here, Alex. Looking ahead, there's going to be some sort of transition inevitably, and that's going to be under maybe a Guaido administration. He presented last year a transitional government agenda under the Plan País title, and it consists of a variety of national reconstruction initiatives that includes also a series of proposals to address the instability driven by foreign forces that are maintaining the status quo of the Maduro regime. So what role do you think that the United States and a Guaido transitional government can play in helping extinguish some of these forces that are going to have to be addressed even apart from Maduro being ousted himself?
Yeah, I think after Maduro goes will be when the real challenge starts to almost sort to stabilize Venezuela. And I think the Americans won't want to get involved in another war on terror like they have in the Middle East by addressing the FARC and the ELN. I think the Venezuelan military itself is going to have to confront them. They probably will be offered American assistance and maybe American military equipment to help oust them. But there's something that I've known for a while. I've never really posted about this, but there is agreements in place for after Maduro leaves for the Americans to help out in terms of aid into Venezuela. You know, there's big plans already in place for the Americans to help Venezuela once Maduro is ousted. This is something that has been worked on last year and has been worked on with Guaido's representatives. I mean, the plan is in place for once Maduro leaves to rescue Venezuela in the short term. But in the long term, they're going to have to find some sort of way to address the problems of the criminal organizations and the terrorist groups that have so far been allowed to roam free across Venezuela.
And it should be noted that the United States was successful in doing so with its Plan Colombia agenda. It was a multi-year, multi-billion dollar joint cooperative effort with the Colombian government to help build the capacity of Colombian law enforcement and military forces when they were looking to expel some of the entrenched drug trafficking networks within their country as well. So maybe allowing the DEA to return to Venezuela to resume operations would be a crucial step in identifying all of the lingering criminal cartel elements in the country, including and especially the colectivos.
Yeah, the colectivos will pose a big problem as well, because, I mean, Maduro has given them the guns, so I think after Maduro leaves, there will be a lot of instability for a while. But yeah, the DEA could return, but I think most of the work will have to be done by Venezuela's own military and Venezuela's own intelligence services, because I think once you start getting foreign militaries intervening, it almost legitimizes the fight of some of these groups against America or a new government. I know the US is planning in terms of aid. I think they are planning something similar to what happened in the aftermath of the Haiti earthquake a few years ago. They're planning some sort of large-scale aid intervention into Venezuela, but the military intervention, even after, to root out these terrorist groups and criminal organisations, I don't think is worth the risk of America getting involved in another war on terror. And I think the Venezuelan military will have a lot of work to do to right the wrongs that have been done since Hugo Chavez.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. Ultimately, I think they will have to assume that responsibility and one can only hope that they will rise to the occasion. If readers want to look more into your assessments, your analysis, your geolocations, and your open source intelligence findings, where can our listeners find you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter. My at is at ConflictsW. I post most of the time on Twitter, but I also do some more in-depth articles on auroraintel.net. I post quite frequently, maybe once a month or so on there, about Venezuela more in depth. But definitely on my Twitter, I'm active every day. There's always something to post about and always something to investigate. So if you want to contact me or know more about me or anything, the information is all on my Twitter account.
Yes, I 100% agree. I'm going to sound very biased here, but your account is absolutely my favorite one to follow when it comes to Venezuela. So listeners, I cannot stress that enough. Go find him on at ConflictsW, those of you who are on Twitter. You can find him as well on auroraintel.com. Aurora is A-U-R-O-R-A. So with that, I want to wrap things up. Alex, you're providing an invaluable service to the Venezuelan community. There are very few sources that accurately report on the grim reality of our country in English, and it really helps those of us living in English-speaking countries that want to share it with our friends and our followers. So keep on doing that great job.
Thank you, Raphael. Thanks for having me on the podcast. And I'm glad that I'm helping people.
Absolutely. Yeah, you guys are an open window for information about reality in Venezuela. So again, thank you so much, Alex, for your time. Thanks again for tuning into the State of Venezuela podcast. I hope you enjoyed hearing the story of our country as much as I enjoyed sharing it. If you enjoyed today's episode, please be sure to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming platform you use. I'd also be grateful if you could leave a review and share it with anyone who might be interested in learning more about Venezuela as well. Finally, if you have any thoughts on today's episode or topics you'd like me to cover in future episodes, drop a comment or send me an email at stateofvenezuela@gmail.com. Thanks again. See you all in the next one.